his son Daniel, and when Daniel came down the hall and saw his mother, the first words out of his mouth were, "Is Dad still alive?" She said, "Yeah."
Lieutenant Colonel Rob Grunewald. Around noon, I say, I'm going inside to call my wife because cell phones weren't working. I go in, and it's really eerie because there's nobody in the Pentagon. All the doors were locked. People were so security conscious that they locked all their doors and shut their doors. I could find no place to call my wife. Finally, I found an electrical closet and called my wife. She was all in a panic, and she said, "How are you?" I said, "I'm fine. I made it out." She says, "You sound terrible." At that point, I realized I had a terrible cough.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. Seconds became minutes. Minutes became hours. It was 1:47 in the afternoon. I shared a cell phone amongst 100 people. We couldn't get a call out. Whoever could get a signal, we used the phone. As it was my turn, I could taste the adrenaline in my mouth as I was shaking, and I could hear the fear in my wife's voice when she answered. I said, "I'm okay. I love you. And I'm staying."
Ileana Mayorga, Management Specialist, Volunteer Arlington. At 1 o'clock, the phone started ringing. People who want to come and help. I put the names of all these people in an Excel sheet and what it is that they wanted to do. They wanted to help dig out the people at the Pentagon. They wanted to secure the area themselves. They wanted to enlist to go and fight. I had a man who called and he said, "I am 80 years old. I still fit in my pilot uniform from World War II. I can still see. I can still hear. I have kept up with my training as a pilot. Tell whoever you can tell that I'm ready to report for duty." That broke my heart. This 80-year-old man saying that.
Chris Combs. By early that afternoon, unsolicited citizens were showing up with food and water. I can very distinctly remember being at the command center and all of a sudden every supermarket showed up with more food. All the vegetables, fruits, all kinds of fruits. I don't know if I was that hungry, but it was the best grapes I ever had.
Ileana Mayorga. We had people from all over the United States calling. We had a company, a trucking business, and they had heard that they needed trucks to remove the debris. I was able to talk to one of the persons at the incident command, and they said, "Yes, we need trucks, but we need trucks that are new because we need to preserve everything that we remove. Something that is old will be rusted, and so it's not going to help us." I called that lady. I said, "I'm sorry, yes, we need trucks, but they have to be new." The lady said, "At least I can purchase one. Tell them that I will purchase one that is new so we can come and help."
Kyra Pulliam, dispatcher, Arlington County Police Department. We had one officer who stopped a pickup truck that had volunteer firefighters from Maryland ready to go down and help.
Mike Walter. Later in the day, there was this kid, probably about 18 years old, showed up. He was trying to get past the police line. He had piercings and all this stuff, like, geez, who's this guy? He was getting very emotional, and he said to the police, "Please, I need to go. I need to give blood. I need to help these people."
Ileana Mayorga. It was completely amazing. The feeling of support, of unity. I felt so proud that my community, the Hispanic community, were calling. Suddenly, the phones were ringing and saying, "This is the country that we chose to come to. Nobody will destroy our country." They would say, "I'm not legal in the United States. Do you think they will accept me to do volunteer work?"
Lieutenant Michael Nesbitt, Defense Protective Service, Pentagon. We have two phone closets. If we lost those phones, the Pentagon would be basically shut down. One individual, Al Tillis, the head of Verizon, had to walk home to Old Town Alexandria, about 5 miles. He rode his bike back here and kept the phone lines up. He didn't leave for 5 days.
I'd bet my children's future. Airborne, somewhere over the plains. Even hours after the attacks were over, the president's team still believed it was not safe for the president to return to Washington. Instead, they headed from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana
to Offutt Air Force Base outside Omaha, Nebraska. During the Cold War, Offutt had been the home of the nation's nuclear forces, Strategic Air Command, and it had the military's best communications abilities outside of the Pentagon, as well as a secure underground bunker.
Lieutenant General Tom Keck. As he takes off, two F-16s pulled up on his wing. That made me think that we were finally getting our act together. Kurt Bedke, one of the other officers, told me later that as we watched them fly away, I said to him, "Do you feel like you're in a Tom Clancy novel?"
Major Scott Hooter Krog. We started following Air Force One North. At some point, I was expecting them to turn east and head to Washington. The longer we're heading north, the more I realized something's still unsettled. They still don't feel safe returning to Washington. I asked for a tanker to come meet up, and after I hooked up, I asked him for every radio channel between here and Canada.
Ann Compton, reporter, ABC News. In each cabin on board Air Force One, three digital clocks stare out from the bulkhead. The LED numerals show the time in Washington, the time at the current location, and the time at the plane's destination. The three clocks read 1:36 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, until the destination clock snapped to Central Time, 12:36 p.m. That was our only stunning confirmation that Air Force One was headed west, away from Washington.
Andy Card, Chief of Staff, White House. There were lots of tears. There were lots of quiet moments staring at a TV screen. No conversation. There were prayers. And the fear. It wasn't even a roller coaster because we were just in the pits. Oh my God, that's terrible. And that's worse. And that's even worse. All the time we're being handed notes, taking telephone calls, giving orders.
Major Scott Hooter Krog. It was an eerie silence on the radio. There's no one in the air. We're talking among ourselves, the fighter pilots on our radios. I wonder if we're going to Canada. A lot of, man, this is fucked up. I'm also talking the guys through what happens if we have to shoot someone down. The world's watching. Let's be by the book and let's do everything we can to protect the president. We know this would be a plum target, but we also figure no one would expect Air Force One right now to be flying north over Kansas.
Ari Fleischer. There was no live television. It put us in a very different spot than most Americans that day. People around the world were riveted to their television sets. We had it intermittently on Air Force One. We had it in Barksdale at the base commander's office. But there's no email on Air Force One back then. When you're in the air, you're cut off.
Eric Draper, presidential photographer. Everyone was starving for information. We couldn't hear anything unless the plane was flying over a major city.
Ellen Eckert, stenographer, White House. The plane is like the Twilight Zone. There's no one on board anymore. The staff cabin is empty. The guest cabin is empty. That's when it was really coming apart for me. I saw one of the agents was standing in the hallway, and I went up to him. "So this is the safest place to be? This is Air Force One, right?" He said, "We might as well have a big red X on the bottom of this plane. We're the only plane in the sky." That was scary. I went into the bathroom and used one of those Air Force One notepads to write a letter to my family. 6 siblings and 2 parents. They're never going to see this. It's going to burn up in a fiery inferno. One of the flight attendants opened the door and comforted me and gave me a washcloth to wipe. We've got this. We're all together.
Major Scott Hooter Krog. 15 minutes after we tanked up, we saw Air Force One start to descend. I did the math and figured out they were probably headed to Offutt. Well, now, we had a full tank of gas. You can't land like that on a small plane, so we were doing afterburner 360s at 7,000 feet to burn off enough gas to land.
Mike Morrell, Presidential Briefer, Central Intelligence Agency. On the way from Barksdale to Offutt, the president asked to see me alone. It was just me, him, and Andy Card. He asked me, "Michael, who did this?" I explained that I didn't have any actual intelligence, so what you're going to get is my best guess. He was really focused and said, "I understand, get on with it." I said that there were two countries capable of carrying out an attack like this, Iran and Iraq. but I believe both would have everything to lose and nothing to gain from the attack. When all was said and done, the trail would lead to Osama bin Laden. I told him I'd bet my children's future on that.
A large, smoldering hole in the ground. Afternoon in Shanksville. In Shanksville, rescuers quickly realized there was nothing to rescue. In their place, hundreds of state troopers and scores of investigators from the FBI, FAA, National Transportation Safety Board, and other agencies moved in to secure the scene of the attack and begin examining the wreckage. They knew they'd be there for a while.
Andrea Damon, Special Agent, Evidence Response Team, FBI. That first day, it was pretty much looking at the site, seeing what had happened, and trying to figure out what resources we needed to bring in.
Tony James, Investigator, FAA. I recognized part of the landing gear and part of the engines. The FBI said, well, what we'd like to do is recover the cockpit. I said, you'll never find the cockpit. You'll never find the people because they vaporize and go away because this airplane hit really hard.
Wells Morrison, Supervisory Special Agent, FBI. We recovered a number of items of evidentiary, significant evidentiary value at our crash site. Unlike the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, we didn't have the tons and tons of debris on top of our aircraft, so we were able to recover things. We recovered items that we believe were used as weapons, small knives and things of that nature, from our crash site.
Sergeant Patrick Madigan, Commander Somerset Station, Pennsylvania State Police. This site was one of the richest, as far as evidence, of the planes that crashed on September 11th.
Wells Morrison. The first item, this is interesting, with all the utter devastation that occurred, the first significant item of evidentiary value was recovered by a state trooper standing post the evening of 9/11. It was the wallet of one of the hijackers, and it was intact, lying on the top of the ground. We also recovered what basically was a to-do list from one of the hijackers. It was very productive.
Sergeant Denise Miller. We watched for persons that were still trying to get into the area to get souvenirs. It was comical. We saw, as we were sitting in the field, a herd of sheep following something. The sheep were following people walking through the field to get to the site. We turned them back around.
Team Michael Laufer, Trooper, Pennsylvania State Police. We arrested a couple of people that were coming in. Everyone wanted to see what was going on, I guess. They actually had mail from the flight, and they were carrying it out through the woods. We rounded them up. I remember it was a guy and a girl.
Braden Schober, firefighter, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. As things progressed, there were remnants of little brush fires, spot fires, that would flare up now and then. Because they didn't want all the equipment out and disturbing the scene, one would flare up, and they'd have to send a crew of a couple guys in with Indian tanks that you wear on your back and spray water, take a rake, and knock these down.
Rick King, Assistant Chief, Shanksville Volunteer Fire Company. A good 5-6 hours afterwards, I hadn't been off the crash site that whole time anywhere. We started to go out to the road. I saw satellite trucks everywhere.
Lieutenant Robert Weaver, Pennsylvania State Police. That first 8-10 hours went by like minutes. Before you knew it, we had a small city up there and an old mining company, and we had hundreds of people.
Tom Ridge, Governor of Pennsylvania. I was enjoying a long weekend away from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in my home community of Erie, Pennsylvania. After word of the attacks, I had to immediately get to Shanksville. A couple of us, my staff and members of the state police detail, boarded an old Army Chinook helicopter. As we were flying to Shanksville, there wasn't much conversation. I do remember that it was very silent, very solemn, everyone deep in their own thoughts. As we descended into the area, I expected to see what I had and what Americans had unfortunately seen during the coverage of commercial aviation accidents. A field littered with significant pieces of the airplane, the fuselage, the tail, the engine, the wings. I'll never forget my shock, my amazement, at seeing what was basically a large smoldering hole in the ground.
Rick King. A big two-wing Chinook helicopter came flying toward us and then came over top the crash site. You could see, plain as day, a guy leaning out the window in a white shirt, and it was Governor Tom Ridge.
Sergeant Patrick Madigan. Governor Ridge flew in and landed at the site. He wanted a briefing, what was going on at that time, and I gave him what information I had, which was really limited at that time. I remember him making the statement that anything we needed to do our job, he'd make sure that was provided for us. I recall him being very, very concerned and very determined.
William Baker, 911 Addressing Specialist and Deputy Director, Emergency Management Agency, Somerset County. I remember Governor Ridge standing right across the table from me, and he said, "Obviously, this is related to the other incidents."
Jerry Longman, reporter, New York Times. They had a staging area in a cornfield where Governor Ridge had a press conference.
Rick Earle, reporter, WPXI-TV, Pittsburgh. Tom Ridge came in there, and he stole a line from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address about people won't remember what we say here, but they'll never forget what these people did here.
Steve Aaron, Deputy Communications Director for Governor Tom Ridge. The thing that most stands out to me that day was the flight home. You get back on the helicopter, and the rear of the helicopter is open, and so the whole way home is this beautiful sunset. It was a gorgeous day. We can't talk to each other because of the helicopter noise, so we're all sitting there with our thoughts.
This is what we have for the nuclear winter. At Mount Weather. The day's attacks activated a system aimed at preserving the continuity of government of the United States. A classified system never before used. Within hours, helicopters from the Air Force's 1st Helicopter Squadron scooped up congressional leaders from the West Lawn of the Capitol and from Andrews Air Force Base and flew them to a mountain bunker originally built for the Cold War. Over the course of the day, other staff and personnel also flowed out to that undisclosed location, later revealed to be Mount Weather in Berryville, Virginia, 80 minutes west of Washington, while other officials were evacuated to Raven Rock, another massive mountain bunker intended to serve as the backup Pentagon and built in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, near Camp David.
Representative Dennis Hastert, House Speaker. I was heading out to Andrews Air Force Base. I finally talked to the Vice President. He was still in the White House. He said he brought all the planes down. After having a discussion with the Vice President, he said, "You're going to an undisclosed location." Next thing, I was in a helicopter, flying over the south side of Washington. We flew over Reagan National Airport, and there's nothing moving on the tarmac. I looked out the other side of the helicopter, and there were flames pouring out of the Pentagon building and blue-black smoke.
Senator Tom Daschle. I was called and told that the decision had been made to evacuate to this undisclosed location. I could bring one staff person, Laura Petru.
Laura Petru, Staff Director for Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. We were told to report to the West Lawn of the Capitol. The helicopter was right there with several armored vehicles around. I was already in the helicopter or about to get in when somebody looked at me and said, "You have clearance, right?" I said, "No." They said, "Well, doesn't matter."
Brian Gunderson. We all piled into this helicopter and the safety instructions were shouted at us over the helicopter's engine.
Laura Petru. I remember thinking, I have no idea where we're going or how long we're going to be there.
Representative Dennis Hastert. I ended up at an undisclosed location. Senator Lott was there, as was Senator Daschle and Dick Gephardt, the minority leader, other members of the leadership. Brian Gunderson. We went deep in the countryside and then landed at the undisclosed location. We got out, and this gentleman walks up to the helicopter, who I gather was the mayor of this facility. He said something very chipper, something along the lines of welcome to and the name of this place. I remember being impressed that even though it's this guy's job to be ready for an event like this, he was in fact ready and very calm about it. This day starts like any other, and next thing you know, he's got all these government officials descending on him in these Huey helicopters.
Laura Petru, there's a web of people within the government who take over. They tell you what to do, and you do what they say.
Brian Gunderson, there were these guys standing in the landing zone wearing their gray urban combat uniforms, holding their M16s.
Laura Petru, they split our group up and put us in the cars. It was pretty odd driving into this underground place.
Senator Tom Daschle, it's a very stark place. Rooms that are very nondescript, white walls, very basic chairs and tables.
Laura Petru, it was very Spartan. It was basically different shades of gray everywhere. We were taken through some tunnels and eventually into a room filled with cubicles, desks.
Steve Elmendorf, Chief of Staff for House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt. There was a group of people there who had been staffing that location who had been waiting since the Cold War for somebody to show up.
John Feary, Press Secretary to Speaker Dennis Hastert. It was a sense of wonderment that, oh boy, so this is what we have for the nuclear winter.
Brian Gunderson. There were obviously preparations for us to stay for a long while if we had to. As we went through it, we crossed through one room that had a set of law books, a set of the U.S. Code, in case we had to do any legislating while we were there.
Senator Tom Daschle, we were put on a speakerphone with the president. I think the president first, then the vice president second, to talk about circumstances. Basically, they recounted their own experiences, where they were, what they knew from intelligence briefings they had been given.
Brian Gunderson. They made some snacks available. I remember that there were a few bags of Cheetos and Doritos and a few sodas that had been cracked open. And we all sat around and looked at the TV screen and watched the tape of the towers coming down. That's where we stayed for several hours.
Steve Elmendorf. While we were at the secure location, the main thing that struck me was our main source of information was CNN, still. We sat in a room, the top leaders of the House and the Senate together, and we watched CNN. Cheney called several times and briefed people, but I don't remember receiving any information that was any different from what I was watching on TV.
John Feary, there was the sense of shock. There was also a sense of confusion. The members felt very nervous. The leadership on both sides, the House and Senate, were isolated from the rest of their members, and that's not where you want to be.
Laura Petru, they didn't feel good about being separated from their colleagues and their families. Almost from the moment they got there, they wanted to go back.
Steve Elmendorf. One of the phone calls with Cheney, Don Nichols, who was the Senate Republican whip at the time, suggested that we ought to leave. He was agitated, asking, "Why are we all here? The situation is clear. We need to go back." Cheney was clearly annoyed by this, and his voice came out of the speakerphone in the middle of the table and said, "Don, we control the helicopters. We'll decide when you leave."
Brian Gunderson. I got calls from other leadership staff that were still at the Capitol Police headquarters with other members of Congress. They basically were calling up saying, "Well, the mood's actually pretty ugly here."
John Feary. One member of Congress told the speaker that he thought he was a coward for not coming back. It was decided that we were going to have a press conference on the Capitol steps to show the American people that we were not going to let the terrorists win.
Brian Gunderson. At that point, all civilian air traffic had been grounded, so there were no non-military aircraft flying over U.S. airspace. There was a feeling that the security situation had stabilized, that there was some confidence that there weren't going to be follow-on attacks, at least not immediately, and so that it was safe to go back. Eventually, the decision was made that, yes, it's time. We can get back in the helicopters.
John Feary. I called one of my assistants, Paige Ralston, who was back in the Capitol Police building, and she helped organize this press conference on the Capitol steps. Trent Lott wanted it only to be the leadership involved. I made the call that we were going to have all the members there.
Representative Dennis Hastert. We didn't know what was facing us, but we knew that there was a lot of legislative things that we had to do. We got the word that the president was going to come back and land in Washington at 6 o'clock. We figured we'd come in right behind the president.
We're in a survival mode. At ground zero. As some semblance of organization came to the carnage at the World Trade Center, a suddenly hallowed space that in the days ahead would first be called the pile and then ground zero, agony-filled rescuers worked determinedly to find survivors.
William Jimeno. Believe it or not, someone did find us. Probably within an hour after Dominic passing, someone came above the hole and said, "Who's down there?" I yelled, "Jimeno, PAPD." I said, "We've got officers down." The voice left us. It was very, very frustrating, and I was very mad, and I said to Sarge, "How could they leave us?" Sergeant McLaughlin says, "We don't know what's happening up there. This person could be injured. This person could be delusional. You've got to keep focused." I said, "Sarge, I'm in a lot of pain. I'm in an extreme amount of pain." Sergeant McLaughlin said, "You gotta hold on."
Detective Steven Stefanakos, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 10, NYPD. They asked all members of the Emergency Service Unit who were there to mobilize, ironically, at the Police Memorial in Battery Park City. There's 10 emergency service squads throughout the city. We lined up in those 10, 1 through 10, right by the memorial. That's when we started to realize who was actually missing.
Sal Cassano, Assistant Chief, FDNY. I was taken to the hospital. A few broken ribs and some bumps and bruises, but I was cleared. I called for someone to take me back to headquarters and started to work in the operational center, handling phone calls, trying to put together a list of the people that were missing, the companies that were missing, and see where we were. We were trying to wrap our arms around this.
Dan Nigro. We put out fires in the streets where all the cars were burning. We put out fires in some buildings as the day went on, but we realized we did not have enough water and time to put out Building 7 of the World Trade Center. I said, after what happened, let's make a collapse zone around this building.
Scott Strauss, Officer, Emergency Service Unit, Truck 1, NYPD. We came around the corner from City Hall Park, and we saw one of our emergency service vehicles on fire. It was like a movie. It's like, no, this is Lower Manhattan. This doesn't happen in Lower Manhattan. It happens in the Middle East somewhere.
Lieutenant Michael Michelson, Wilton, Connecticut Fire Department. As they were pulling the trucks out of the wreckage that first day, starting to move things, you're looking at a fire truck, which most people view as incredibly strong and incredibly indestructible. These things were broken like little kids' toys. It was like they were made out of paper mache and then stepped on.
Scott Strauss, we were finding plenty of body parts, but we weren't finding anybody who was rescuable. We kept doing that all day long.
Dan Nigro. At that point, we were trying to find anybody we could rescue.
William Jimeno. We kept going back and forth, trying to keep each other going. I would yell at the sergeant if I heard him fading away. He would yell at me if I was fading away. All I could do was hope and pray, and that's something we did. We prayed together at one point. McLaughlin said, "I don't even know your first name." I said, "Will." He said, "Mine's John."
Still trapped inside the devastated but miraculously intact stairwell B of the North Tower, a handful of surviving FDNY firefighters hoped their colleagues outside would find them.
Pasquale Bazzelli. The firemen who were in stairway B also, they were below me. They were like the second or third floor, I believe, and they were in more of a cocoon, part of the building that didn't collapse. I was on the 22nd floor, and I basically fell to what was the height of the rubble, which, if the building was still standing, it would have been the fourth floor. I basically fell 18 floors. I ended up maybe about 75 yards to the north. As it crumbled, the stair didn't stay exactly center. I was on a pile of rubble, a little ledge, with my feet dangling from my knees down. I started calling out for people that I was with to see if anyone was around me. I started calling out for help. I didn't see anyone for a while. An hour went by, and I was still calling out for help.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. I couldn't move too much, so I started pushing. Nothing was giving. I pushed over my head and the debris started to move. I made a little hole for myself. I crawled out. I had a beam over me. I'm sitting on the beam and now I'm thinking, what do I do now? Now I'm in the staircase proper.
Captain J. Jonas. We got about half a landing down and the word came from downstairs. We can't get out from down here. We're trying to figure out what happened. We're alive. We're coughing, gagging. We have very limited visibility. I can see walls of twisted steel around us. We're in a stairway that's intact but filled with debris. There are no lights.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, I started hearing noises. I started hearing moaning and guys were starting to communicate, yell out. These were the guys that I was trapped with. They were calling out, "Who's there? You guys all right?" I realized I wasn't alone. When you find out you're with other people, it makes you feel a lot better.
Captain J. Jonas, I got a Mayday message from Lieutenant Mike Wercola from Ladder 5, who we saw on the 12th floor, that he was trapped on the 12th floor in the B stairway, and he's hurt badly. I was the highest one on the stairway, so I started climbing the stairway trying to move debris. He transmits a second Mayday, and he's a little more distraught the second time. I'm trying to move the debris around, and I can't move it. It's too heavy. The third Mayday came in, and he was even more distraught than the previous time. I get on the radio and say, "I'm sorry, Mike. I can't help you." That was the last we heard of him. In reality, we found out later that the 12th floor didn't exist, that his Mayday was coming from the rubble.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. I jumped onto the other staircase, then I crawled up a few steps and the other guys were there. Lieutenant Jim McQueen from 39 Engine, Chief Richie Picciotto, a couple of the other fellas. There were about six people under the landing.
Captain J. Jonas, we tried to get ourselves out and we couldn't figure out a way. I finally gave out my own Mayday message. "Mayday, Mayday, Mayday, this is the officer of Ladder Company 6. We're in the B stairway and we're trapped." The first man to answer my Mayday was Deputy Chief Tom Herring, a friend. He said, "Okay, I got you recorded. Guys will be coming to get you."
Dan Nigro. When I heard the operation going on for Ladder 6, I thought, they made a mistake. I said, "You can't be rescuing anybody in the North Tower. The North Tower is gone." I did not think it at all possible that anyone could be in that building and be alive.
Captain Joe Downey. When they located the guys in the stairwell, it was a mad rush trying to get those people out, to identify where they were.
Captain J. Jonas. We gave them, all these guys who came from all the firehouses in the outer boroughs, we gave them a focal point. This is, wow, the six is trapped, go get them. That was the mission. One of the next people that came on the radio was Nick Visconti, a deputy chief. Nick came to my wedding. I said, "Wow. Nick's here. Nick's running my rescue." He would ask me very strategic questions. He asked me about how I got into the building. I said, "We came in off of West Street. We walked through the glass doors. We made a right and a left, and the B stairway is your first left. You can't miss it." I spoke to Nick a few days later, and he said when he asked me that, he was surrounded by about 100 firemen who were ready to go. When I said, "We walked through the glass doors," there was a collective sigh. Because there wasn't a piece of glass intact for about 20 blocks.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, we tried to force the door off the stairway. They used the axe and the Halligan. It's like a pry bar, and they opened the door. But there was a wall of debris behind it.
Captain J. Jonas, I'm starting to get radio messages. One was from my neighbor, Cliff Stabner. "This is Rescue 3 to Ladder 6, Captain J. Jonas. This is Cliff. I'm coming to get you. Where are you?" I was very good friends with Cliff. He would get me choked up every time I would talk to him on the radio because he would end every radio transmission by saying, "I'm coming for you, brother. I'm coming for you."
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, Now I figured at least they knew where we were. I didn't realize that everything was gone. It was a big pile of debris.
Captain J. Jonas. Another person that got on the radio was Bill Blanche, a chief over here in the 1st Battalion. I had worked with him. He was the only one that gave me a little glimpse into how bad it was going to be. He says, "This is going to take a real long time. It's really bad out here." I had come to the realization that we might be here for a few days.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. They started searching for us maybe an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. I really lost track of the time.
Captain J. Jonas. We also had a chief that was below us, below the guys from Engine 39, named Richard Prunty. He was beyond the point that there was a huge area of debris. Every time I gave our location, he would get on the radio and say, "Don't forget about Battalion 2. Yes, we have Battalion 2.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. He was about 20 feet below us, and he was trapped up to his chest in debris, and he was losing consciousness. I remember we were talking to him on the radio and telling him to hang in there. The last thing he said was, "Tell my wife and kids I love them." And that was it.
Captain J. Jonas. At one point during our entrapment after the collapse, we had an explosion that shook the area. One of my firemen from Ladder 6, Tommy Falco, looked up at me. He says, "Hey, Cap, what do we do now?" I looked at him and I says, "I don't know. I'm making this up as I go along."
The two sons of Ray Downey, FDNY's head of special operations, both firefighters, searched carefully for their father, reconstructing his movements amid the chaos following the twin collapses.
Lieutenant Chuck Downey. There were so many guys looking to help out, but there was so much to cover. Voids all over the place. Everybody was crawling, whatever you could move to lift up. It's a tremendous amount of square area to cover.
Captain Joe Downey. Right from the start, we were trying to locate our father. Our agenda was to find out where he was and where he could possibly have survived. Right from the beginning, we were asking questions. He survived the first building, and he went back in.
Lieutenant Chuck Downey. There were quite a few people that saw him at the command post, saw him across West Street.
Captain Joe Downey. As it was clearing, before it even cleared, they said he was the first one back out on the radio trying to get everybody out of the North Tower.
Lieutenant Chuck Downey. He turned people away. As he came out, he was, a couple of eyewitness reports said, all white, brushing stuff off his face, radioing people to get out of the North Tower, and directing others to head north on West Street.
Captain Joe Downey. We know where he was when the second building came down. He was helping this gentleman coming out of the Marriott. Two of our firefighters were trapped in the Marriott when the first building came down, in the hotel lobby. They were working their way out. He saw the guys coming out. Him and Chief Stack, Larry Stack, stayed there with a heavyset gentleman that they couldn't move. It was the two chiefs and this civilian. I feel he knew he wasn't going to come out, and he made that conscious decision on doing what he had to do. He probably couldn't have lived with himself, the type of person that he is, if he did go away from the building when his guys were still in the building. He could have easily walked to West Street like everybody else. He couldn't leave that gentleman, and he couldn't leave his companies up in the North Tower.
Lieutenant Chuck Downey. He made a statement to FDNY Captain Alfuentes right when the South Tower came down. There were a lot of good men in that building.
Captain Joe Downey. I think it was almost 100 guys from just his Special Operations Command that died. Special Operations Command includes the 5 rescue companies, 7 squad companies, the hazmat unit. The only one of his companies that didn't get there was Squad 270. Every other company that was there was wiped out.
Pasquale Bazzelli. There were some firemen searching the rubble. They were actually looking for those firemen with Josephine Harris trapped in the stairwell, but they stumbled across me. When I saw the first fireman, I believe it was Mike Morabito, I said, "Hey, help, I'm up here." He said, "What do you need?" I was taken aback. I said, "I'm stuck, I can't get down." He's like, "Oh, all right, we'll get to you in a minute." I'm like, "Okay." He said, you need a rope or something? I said, whatever you need me to do, just tell me. He looked at me again. He said, who are you with? Because I had a blue shirt on, black pants, he thought I was another fireman searching the rubble that got stuck. I was like, I was in the building. It collapsed. I said, I'm stuck here. I can't get down. He said, holy shit, guys, we got a survivor. He got on the radio and then he goes, hold on, we'll get to you.
Louise Bazzelli. People started coming over to the house and the phone kept ringing and ringing and ringing. I didn't want to talk to anyone unless it was him on the other end.
Pasquale Bazzelli. I was about 15 feet up on the edge of a cliff. For a while, they were looking up at me like, I don't know how we're going to get him down from there. Jimmy Kiesling, who was part of their special ops and trained for that, luckily he was with them. He carried a bunch of ropes with him. I saw him make his way around me. He climbed around and up this mountain of debris, found his way, climbed down to me, and jumped in right behind me. He goes, all right, big guy, we're going to get you down.
Louise Bazzelli. By the time Pasquale's mom and my father came, they lived in Jersey City, it was about 1:30 in the afternoon. The worst thing for me was to see her walk through the door and see me with this big belly. She screamed and fell apart. She grabbed onto me and she was saying, my son. She said, this baby's gotta have a father. This baby's gotta have a father.
Pasquale Bazzelli. He was tugging on stuff and looking at things. He finally found this pipe. It might have been the standpipe that used to run through the stairs, all mangled. He did a couple of loops of the rope and he goes, throw yourself off the ledge and I'll lower you down. I fell a couple of feet, then the rope got taut and it grabbed me. I remember spinning a little bit. Little by little, he lowered me down.
Captain J. Jonas. It was soon after I spoke to Billy Blanche about him saying it's really bad out here that a ray of light hit the stairway. It was a beam of light, like a pencil coming down. I could see a little sliver of blue sky. I looked down at the guys. Guys, there used to be 106 floors over our heads, and now I can see sunshine, I says. This may not be as bad as we thought it was.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, it was clearly sunlight. It was all dirty and full of debris. It looked like pepper was floating around in it, but it was sunlight. I'm amazed. A 106-story building above us, and I'm looking up at the sun.
Captain J. Jonas. Things started to pick up. We had a little bit better visibility. We could look around. We could see all the areas where we would possibly get out. We thought that we may have been buried under mounds of debris, maybe several stories high. Now we realize we are on the top of the mountain. We found an area where we could breach a wall, and we did. We could see outside.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, we decided to go one at a time and try to climb out. We climbed up, got to the opening, and we started squeezing our way out.
Captain J. Jonas. We looked out initially, and we could see there's all kinds of buildings on fire. We could see smoke. We could see twisted rubble all around. At this time, firefighter Rich Picciotto wanted out of the stairway. I said, wait. Every decision that I was making was on the side of safety. I says, look. We've lived to this point. Let's be careful here before we do anything. We waited a little while longer, and then we could see a fireman in the distance. It's all right. Now we can go. We had our life-saving rope with us. It's a 150-foot-long rope in a bag. We rigged it up so we could lower Rich Picciotto out. He made contact with a fireman we saw in the distance, who was a fireman from Ladder 43. We start sending people out.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. Just at that point, a couple of firefighters from the outside had made it to that opening and they helped us come out. They set up a rope because there was nothing to hold on to. It wasn't like you were coming out on a flat surface. You were coming out on twisted beams and we were high, maybe about 20 feet in the air.
Captain J. Jonas, I knew we had people below us. I didn't know who they were. It wasn't until they came up that I knew who they were. That's when I saw Mickey Cross. I said, oh, I didn't realize it was you. Mickey came out and Bobby Bacon from Engine 39, the rest of the guys from Engine 39, it took them a bit longer to get out. We still had Josephine Harris with us. I told one of the rescuers about Lieutenant Warkola in Ladder 5. I said they're on the 12th floor. He looked at me like this. I said, "Why the look?" He said, "You'll find out." There was no 12th floor.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. I got to a point where I was looking down the pile and I saw firefighters coming up. I knew they were fresh troops. They weren't covered in dust. I had a bloody nose and I was totally encased in this dust. It must have been some sight. I saw the guys coming up. It turned out to be guys from my firehouse. I saw my captain and he said, "Mickey, you're alive?" They all thought I was dead.
Captain J. Jonas. Going across the rubble field, we crossed between the North Tower and the smaller buildings. The New York office for the Secret Service, they had their ammunition depot inside the World Trade Center. Munitions started going off as we were crossing, and it almost sounded like a war zone. In addition to everything else that was going on, we could hear bullets going off. We're thinking, this is bad.
Scott Strauss. While we were digging into one of these crevices, we heard gunfire. Not all of us had radios, so we weren't sure what was going on. We heard fighter jets flying overhead. Now, everybody had the luxury, and I know it's not the best word to use, but they had the luxury of watching this on TV. We were in it. They had news commentators guessing or trying to explain what's happening. We were in the middle of this, and we were hearing gunfire. We were thinking whoever attacked us is now in a ground fight. They're coming in, and they're going to shoot the place up and kill many more people.
William Jimeno. As the evening progressed, we heard more gunfire, and we didn't know what it was. Now today we know the ammunition was blowing off. I said, "Sarge, we must be in an ongoing gun battle with the terrorists."
Captain J. Jonas. They were getting ready to whisk me away to an ambulance, and I says, "Wait a minute, where's the command post?" They said, "Forget about the command post, we gotta take care of you." I said, "No, you don't understand, there had to be hundreds of people looking for us." I said, "If somebody gets hurt now, I don't know if I can live with that." The command post was a fire department pumper that was still hooked up to a hydrant. Chief Pete Hayden was on top, along with Chief James DiDomenico. They were standing on top of the pumper so they could look out across the debris field. There had to be a couple hundred firemen surrounding the pumper. It was really quite a sight to see. I finally got Chief Hayden's attention, and I gave him a salute, and I started crying. He looked down, and he started crying too. He said, "Jay, it's good to see you." I says, "It's good to be here."
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. There was a table out there on West Street and a chief sitting at it, like a picnic table. That was the command post for that area. That's all they had. I walked up to him and he said to me, "Give me your riding list. Your riding list is what you carry with everybody's name that's working. When you start every tour, you fill it out with a pen and a piece of carbon paper. It's very old-fashioned. You put your name, you put the company name, the date, the tour, battalion, division, officer, and underneath is the chauffeur. That was Ronnie Sifu that day, and who was working? Tim Marmion, Paul Lee, and Pete Faluca. The original, it's clipped onto the engine, and the carbon goes in your pocket." I gave it to him, and he looked at it. He said, "I have your name on the list. They had me listed as missing, presumed dead." I said, "No, I'm here. Take my name off that list." They had a list like over 400 names. At this point, I remember looking at my watch, and it was 10 after 2 p.m.
Captain J. Jonas. I had one guy I know, Jimmy Riches, come up to me. He sat next to me at the ambulance. He said, "Jay, I was listening to your radio transmissions. That was unbelievable." He said, "Did you see Engine 4 on your travels?" I'm thinking to myself, geez, where's he going with this Engine 4? I said, "No, I didn't see Engine 4. He said, "Oh," he says, "my son was working today." It hit me. I understood the question. Then I came to the realization, oh my God, I wonder how many sons are working today.
Pasquale Bazzelli. I stood up and right away I felt this lightning bolt, the shock go through me. I had broken my foot. The firefighter said, "We have a ways to go. Can you make it?" I'm like, "Yeah, I want out of here." We started climbing and walking, There was one fireman in front of me, one behind me. They tied a rope off, and they each held one end in case I fell. I made it probably halfway, maybe three quarters of the way. The pain in my foot from walking on it, I was sweating. I must have turned pale. So I said, "Guys," I said, "I need a breather. I need to sit for a couple minutes." They looked at me and they said, "We'll handle it from here. You relax. We got it." They got on the radios and they formed a huge line of firemen over the debris. They brought a plastic gurney over and they strapped me into it. And they basically dragged me over the rubble out to the west side where they placed me in an ambulance. When they put me in the ambulance, the paramedic first thing said, "All right, so what hurts?" I was like, "Before we get to that, I need a phone." I said, "My wife is home. She's 7.5 months pregnant. She knows I didn't get out of the building." I called my house, and my wife actually answered the phone.
Louise Bazelli. It was about 3:30 that afternoon, and I happened to walk by the phone because at that point everybody else was answering the phone and saying, "No, she hasn't heard from him. We haven't heard anything. We'll call if anything happens." I walked by the kitchen. The phone was there, and I picked it up. I heard his voice on the other end.
"Pasquale Bazelli." I said, "Louise, it's me, Pasquale." She gasped, "Oh my God, Pasquale, Pasquale, oh my God, you're okay." I heard this huge uproar in the house.
"Louise Bazelli." He said, "I'm in an ambulance right now." He said, "I'm borrowing one of the emergency workers' cell phones to call you. I lost my phone, and I'm on the way down to St. Vincent's Hospital. They're going to treat me down there." I was like, "Are you okay? What happened? Are you all right?"
"Pasquale Bazelli," I said, "I don't know how, but I'm alive. I wanted to tell you."
Louise Bazelli. I couldn't believe the day that it happened from 8:30 in the morning until 3:30 that afternoon. A total 180. To know that he was alive, that I still had him, and that my daughter and my future children would have a father, it was a blessing. Nothing else really mattered.
As the afternoon hours passed and rescue efforts solidified above ground, Will Jimeno and the other Port Authority officers trapped under the South Tower lost hope that they'd be found, as did Janelle Guzman, buried not far from where her co-worker Pasquale Bazelli had been rescued.
"Janelle Guzman. I heard the Motorolas, the walkie-talkies, going off, and you could hear movements, probably trucks. I could hear noises, but didn't hear anybody's voice. Nobody calling out. I called out a couple of times. I called out for help. I was getting breathless, and I was going to shut my eyes and hope not to get up."
"William Jimeno, things were looking very bleak. I wanted to go to sleep and not wake up. I remember being able to take out of my left pocket a card and my pen. My pen wasn't working really good because of the debris, but I was able to etch it into the card, 'Allison, I love you.' I put it back in there, hoping that they would find it if they found my body. Because at this point, I didn't think we were getting out of there."
"Janelle Guzman. I was preparing myself to die. I thought about my mom and my family. I said, 'I'm still breathing, I'm alive, and I need to do something. I need to pray.' I said to myself, 'God, do me a favor. If I have to die under the rubble, let my family find my body so we can have a burial.' Then I asked for another favor from the Lord. I said, 'If I have to die, at least let them get me out of here and see my daughter for one more time. If I make it to the hospital, I'll at least see my daughter for one more time.' I shut my eyes again, wake up, and realize I was still stuck in this building. I said, 'God, do me one more favor. I don't want to die. I want to live. I want to be able to see my daughter and my family. I asked God for a miracle. I asked him to save me. I kept begging the Lord for a second chance. I kept begging him.
Waiting for the injured. At the hospitals. Hospitals across New York City readied themselves for massive casualties within minutes of the first attack, figuring that the large-scale destruction would surely result in thousands or even tens of thousands of injuries. Even farther away, up and down the East Coast, hospitals in cities like Boston prepared to receive overflow injuries and trauma cases. Throughout the day, injured office workers, Manhattan residents, and first responders did seek treatment, but the arriving patients only ever amounted to a trickle, not a flood. Doctors and nurses were left with the sinking realization that no patients meant no survivors.
Michael McAvoy, I spent the rest of the day at the hospitals, at the firehouse, or at my friend's apartment in Greenwich Village. I looked over lists of people who were taken to various hospitals. No John McAvoy, my brother. No James Ladley, my friend who worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. You look at the list and try to will a name onto it.
Tracy Donahue, transit officer, NYPD. I ended up at some point walking from my command to St. Vincent's Hospital because they wanted me to get checked out because I had blood coming out of my ears. I was a mess. When I got to St. Vincent's, it was very creepy because there was no one there. I expected so many people to be there, and I'd be waiting a long time to see a doctor. The doctors were very nonchalant when they saw me. They were waiting for the real bodies to come, the real people. And there was nobody there to come.
Harry Weiser, Tax Counsel, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. I remember arriving at the hospital. I remember somebody asking me a few questions, and I asked them to call Karen, my wife, and I gave them her phone number. I remember somebody saying, "We're going to have to intubate you." I said, "Do what you have to do." That's the very last thing I remember. I don't remember anything for about 7 weeks.
Francine Kelly, registered nurse and nurse manager, St. Vincent's Catholic Medical Center. I think we saw 350 to 450 patients within the first 8 hours of 9/11. We saw tremendous volumes of patients. We saw in those first couple hours some people who worked in the World Trade Center. We saw burns, shrapnel wounds, crush injuries, people in hypertensive crisis. Then, as the day continued, then we started to see rescue workers come in who were injured in their line of duty. Mid-afternoon, 3 or 4 o'clock, we were working nonstop. Then what happened, unfortunately, is all of a sudden things slowed down. That was very, very difficult for us because you kept wanting to hear that ambulance siren.
Joe Esposito, Chief of Department, NYPD. They were waiting for the injured, and they never came.
David Norman. I had a scratched cornea. I was bleeding. I had burns on my legs. They brought us to St. Vincent's Hospital. They cut all our clothes off. We're standing there pretty much naked out on 7th Avenue, and then they gave us hospital gowns and brought us inside and triaged us at that point. They flushed my eye and some other stuff and were able to remove some of the debris that was scratching my cornea. And then I got a patch.
Michael McAvoy. I walked back to St. Vincent's Hospital on 7th Avenue. Maybe I should give blood? At the hospital, there were stretchers and gurneys and tons of nurses and doctors, but no new arriving patients.
John Cahill, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Pataki. We spent that day marshaling state resources for the response. We lined up so many doctors and blood donations, and the reality was, at the end of the day, very little of that was needed.
Mom, is America going to survive this? The 9/11 generation. As the attacks that Tuesday morning unfolded and news spread across the country, it left the nation's children bewildered and confused, and imprinted on all of them, at all ages, lasting memories. Babies.
Cheryl Meyer, parent, Tulsa, Oklahoma. My son, was going to turn 1 month old on the 12th. I had planned to take him out for his first walk in the stroller. It was very hot still in Oklahoma. And I woke up to a voicemail from my brother, who simply said, "Turn on the TV." I sat in shock all morning, and eventually decided to go out on the walk anyway. I remember such a surreal feeling every time a plane would fly over, as many rerouted flights did until air traffic was suspended. I also remember looking at my son and thinking how one day he would know about these horrific events. I wish he didn't have to know such evil exists.
Age 2.
Jenna Green, parent, Maryland. I was running late, driving my 2-year-old son to daycare a block from the White House. We listened to little kids' songs like Wheels on the Bus during the entire drive. I had no idea what was happening, except I heard a lot of sirens. The director of the daycare met us at the front door looking frantic. "Go home," she said. "Turn around right now and go home. It's not safe here." I listened to WTOP radio on the drive back, and my son cried and cried, in part because we weren't listening to Wheels on the Bus, but also because even he could tell something very bad had happened.
Age 3.
Bo Garner, Michigan. My only memory is my mom standing in front of the TV watching the news. I don't remember seeing the towers fall or seeing President Bush address the nation. The only thing I remember is how it affected my mother. The significance of the moment was somehow passed on to me regardless of my lack of comprehension. 9/11 was not just an early memory for me. It's my earliest memory. Just a flash.
Age 5, kindergarten.
Lachlan Francis, 9/11 is the first memory of my life. I remember a clearly distraught Mrs. Blanchard telling us that we would be going home early for the day. My daycare provider picked me and other students up in her minivan and brought us back to her house. This was the only day of daycare that we were ever allowed to watch television. My daycare provider watched the film of planes crashing into the towers on loop as she frantically tried to call her daughter, who lived in Manhattan. The other students and I, clueless to the seriousness and tragedy of what we were watching, nonetheless sat transfixed in front of the couch, watching the video of planes crashing into the Twin Towers over and over and over again.
Blake Richardson, Connecticut. My mom said as soon as she saw on the news that the first plane crashed, she drove to school to pick up my siblings and me. Later, she explained to me that a plane crashed into the World Trade Center, and I had absolutely no idea what that meant. The next morning, I sat down in a circle on the rug with my kindergarten class, and we all talked about what happened. I remember being confused because my mom said the World Trade Center, and my teacher said the Twin Towers, and I thought they were two separate buildings. I didn't know about the other planes until maybe a year or so later. Now I can't imagine how terrifying that must have been for my teacher, to have to explain something so horrific to a room full of 5-year-olds. Jing Chu, Illinois. My mom worked at one of the high-rise buildings closest to the Sears Tower in Chicago. The school got the students home early, but I did not know why at the time. I remember my mom was home earlier than usual, too. She gave me a bath and asked me, "Do you know what happened?" She then told me there was a horrible accident at the World Trade Center in New York City, a place we had visited a few months before. Terrorism and patriotism were not yet ideas that I understood. My mother, along with all the other workers in the tallest buildings in Chicago, were asked to evacuate.
Age 6, first grade.
Kelly Yeo, California. The sky was gray as my babysitter woke me up and told me, "You're not going to school today. There's going to be a war. Bad men have bombed New York City." Ricky Miller, Michigan. I was in Mrs. Smith's first grade class. We had a guest reader in the class reading Nate the Great. Mrs. Smith got a call. Slowly, students were called out of class. By the end of the day, only a few of us were left. My sister, a second grader, and myself among them. When we got home, my mom told us about a terrible attack that took many lives. My mom didn't want us to be scared of school, so she wasn't going to pull us out. Alma M., California. All the adults seemed weird. They were all on edge and something was wrong. Everything was so quiet.
Age 7, second grade.
Robert Korn, Florida. Kids started leaving school early, picked up by their parents starting around 10 a.m. My mom picked me and my best friend up from our school. My mom was crying. She and my dad had both grown up on Long Island, and they lived in Manhattan together for over a decade before moving to Florida. When we got home, my dad made a couple sandwiches for my friend and me. He was a wreck. One of his friends from high school was a firefighter in New York City. He later found out that his friend died in one of the towers, Thomas Joseph Kavakis. I sat outside my house on the back patio with my friend. We ate our peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and we watched the news. We sat there for at least 3 hours before my mom came back outside and turned the TV to the only network not showing the news, Cartoon Network. I knew that what was happening was not normal.
Tanya Cohen, New York. There were Black Hawk helicopters flying over the house into the city. My grandma went into the kitchen and made a big batch of pancakes.
Hiba Alasser, Louisiana. I was a pretty shy and quiet child, but I had made my first friend on my own. After that day, my friend came over and said, "We can't be friends anymore, Hiba." My mom said, "Until this is over, we can't be friends anymore."
Age 8, third grade.
Denise Shiashi, Pennsylvania. My teacher walked me up the steps with tears in her eyes, clenching my hand as if I were her own child. I wondered how something so bad could happen on such a beautiful, warm, and sunny day.
Alexa Cerf, Washington, D.C. I was the new kid in school, so when the teacher said, "You might not know what the Pentagon is, but it's a building that's very important to us," I thought she meant important to our school, that a plane had hit a building on campus. I was too embarrassed to ask which building was the Pentagon, but I tried to look out the window for a plane that had crashed.
Rebecca Portlock, Alabama. That was the first time I realized that truly awful things could happen to people who didn't deserve them.
Jessica Sweeney, New Jersey. Is your mom okay? I stared at my blonde-haired best friend, Alex, as the rest of our third-grade class gazed at the TV. Alex's big blue eyes looked right past me as she said, "I don't know. She had a meeting there this morning." I put my hand on her shoulder. Alex's name stumbled from the loudspeaker, asking her to come to the office. I gave her my package of Dunkaroos, the one my mom had packed me for snack time, before my teacher took Alex downstairs. A few minutes later, Alex ran back into our classroom and hugged me, crying. She told me her meeting in New York got canceled when she was on her way this morning. She turned around before she even crossed the bridge.
Manar Hussein, New Jersey. The banner on the screen appeared with the words and the lines of "suspected Al-Qaeda, an Islamic terrorist group, hijackers," as the news anchor tried to explain that we were under attack. The words were foreign to these third graders, but the word "Islamic" they knew very well. It was the word I had used to introduce myself in these early days of school. A couple students started to look at me, riddling me with hard, questioning stares. I couldn't help but feel ashamed and apologetic for something that had nothing to do with me.
Age 9, fourth grade.
Matthew Jellick, Pennsylvania. Toward the end of the day, the school called on the public address system to inform us about what had happened. We were asked to stand up for a moment of silence as the song "God Bless the USA" played on the PA radio. I saw the magnitude of what happened when I got home and watched the television. It was a very somber experience, and I was feeling like, why? Why did this happen?
Selena Gomez, Texas. Everyone was distraught.
Age 10. Fifth grade.
Karen Dro, California. I was a figure skater and practiced on the 5 a.m. PT session that morning. I don't actually remember what I did during that hour-long session, but I do know that at the end of it, I was happy.
I bounded into the cafeteria, trying to get my mom's attention, gleefully peppering her with questions about whether or not she saw me practice. I expected her to be all smiles. Instead, her face was a sheet of white, as were all the faces of every other parent that was there.
Elizabeth Estrada, Texas. I didn't know what the Twin Towers were or where they were located. I sat on top of one of the desks and cried. My 4-year-old sister, along with her teacher, was later brought into the classroom to watch the news. I remember deliberately sitting behind her so that she couldn't see me cry. I knew that even if she couldn't fully comprehend what was going on, she would still be scared because of all the chaos. September 11, 2001 was the first time I ever doubted the safety of my country.
Kristen Camille Chez, Florida. I couldn't understand why anyone would want to hurt so many people. They couldn't possibly have known them all. What reason did they have?
Nick Waldo, Alaska. My mom told me that some planes had crashed, and being in rural Alaska, I thought a small plane had gone down because of bad weather. I was confused as to why it was a big deal. I said, oh, did we know anyone on them?
Age 11, 6th grade.
Dana Meredith, Kansas. It was the tradition in my elementary school that the 6th grade class take a 3-day, 2-night trip to an outdoor learning center. My class took that trip from September 10th to 12, 2001. I spent September 11th, 2001 having fun with my friends, canoeing in the morning, hiking and exploring an old cemetery in the afternoon, playing soccer and watching Apollo 13 in the evening. Very little was out of place other than the looped contrails of the sky of planes forced to turn around. I still have a photo taken on a disposable Kodak camera, and our principal canceling plans to join us because of disciplinary problems with a student. A white lie, I realized later. Our teacher sat us down the next day before we left for home to explain what had happened. Although I could not conceive of the magnitude of the previous day's events, nor did I even know what the World Trade Center was.
Age 12, 7th grade.
Jose Godinez, California. The events unfolded well before I got up for the second Tuesday of 7th grade. The teacher turned on the news coverage. I was glued to the screen, fascinated by the new terms I was learning. Terrorism had not entered my lexicon before that day. My understanding of the Middle East, until that day, was limited to ancient Egypt.
Irene C. Garcia, California. When my siblings got ready for school, I usually occupied my time with morning cartoons. I remember flipping through the channels and being annoyed that what seemed like every single station was broadcasting the same program. As a child, I just wanted to watch my cartoons. I kept flipping the channels until I decided to watch what was going on. I remember smoke coming out of a building and the broadcaster stating what a sad and tragic thing occurred in New York.
Michael, Pennsylvania. I was looking up the World Trade Center and the encyclopedia that was in the classroom.
Dan Schumann, Minnesota. Mostly, I remember the feeling that went unspoken, or maybe couldn't be put to words even by adults, that something horrible and incomprehensible had happened that had already changed things forever. At home after school, I remember my dad telling me about when JFK was killed when he was 8. He told me that America had gotten through that, and that it would get through this, too.
Age 13, 8th grade.
Emily Bauck, Florida. My dad is a commercial airline pilot. He was working. All middle and high schoolers were herded into the gymnasium. I was hysterical on the bleachers. My Bible teacher pulled me out of the crowd and took me to the principal's office. "Do you know where your dad is?" I didn't. My dad was one of the last planes in the sky, having to turn back to Fort Lauderdale mid-route, inbound to a New York area airport. He was able to answer by the time I called. I'm still thankful for those few moments he was able to tell me he was safe, and for the teacher who looked out for me.
Kat Cosgrove, New Hampshire. I didn't really understand the severity of it. A couple of buildings a few states away had been hit by planes. I'm not sure I had ever said the word terrorism before. Once I got home, I turned on the TV to try to figure out what was going on. I remember scrolling through more than 100 channels, seeing the same images of the Twin Towers falling over and over. I counted 31 TV channels all airing live coverage of 9/11. When I saw that MTV and VH1 were also airing it, that's when I realized how big a deal it was and started to get scared. It was suddenly not an adult problem, but something that I was supposed to be paying attention to, too.
Age 14, ninth grade.
Catherine Mestandria, Connecticut. I remember walking into my social studies classroom and my teacher had written, "Religion is outraged when outrage is done in its name. Gandhi." I couldn't process that it was an act of terrorism. I kept thinking that it was a series of terrible mistakes. Some of our teachers kept the news on. Others attempted with the lessons of the day. At lunch, no one talked, and there was a line that stretched down the hallway to the two payphones at the front of the school. As a bedroom community to New York, nearly everyone had at least one parent who worked in the city. My dad didn't work in Manhattan, but traveled each week for work. I remember waiting in the line, my stomach in knots, waiting to get in touch with my mom to hear that my dad was okay.
Shambi, Alabama. I was trying something new that year, going for a new look, a new identity. I was learning to skateboard and in a punk rock band. A guy by the name of Steven sat in front of me. He was a 10th grader, but for one reason or another, he's in my 9th grade science class. Steven was the kind of guy I wanted to be, the character I was trying to become. Seconds after the television was turned on, before I have time to fully process what I was watching, I leaned forward and whispered to Steven, "Anarchy." He laughed and I instantly feel dirty. The guilt only grew as we continued watching the news. One of the greatest tragedies in our country's history, and the first word out of my mouth was a joke.
Age 15, 10th grade.
Lourdes V. Baker, California. It was the first time I completely understood that nothing is simple. Some things never make sense. And sometimes horrible things happen for no reason at all. It was the end of my childhood.
Bill Cushman, New York. Something that stands out to me the most in my own memory of 9/11 was the juxtaposition between the surreal nature of the day and the monotony of the routines that I still followed. After spending the day at school constantly trying to catch a glimpse of any new bit of information about the terror attacks, I still went to my high school job at my town's public library that evening. I was scheduled to work that day, and I never thought of breaking from that routine. I went to work and numbly made it through the four-hour shift I was working as a sophomore. I can't remember how I found out that my local newspaper, the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, had published an afternoon extra edition to cover 9/11, but by the time my dad picked me up from the library, I knew that I wanted a copy. After a weird Burger King dinner, my dad and I drove around, going from gas station in a futile attempt to find a copy of that extra edition. By this point in the night, the extra editions of the newspaper were long gone, but the quiet quest around town to find one is burned into my 9/11 memories.
Age 16, 11th grade.
John K., California. At around 7 in the morning, the tone on KFI AM 640 changed drastically. Bill Handel read off the news ticker as if aliens had been spotted directly above Wilshire Boulevard. Picking up my carpool, suddenly 16 didn't feel so old.
Talia High, New Jersey. September 11th was also picture day in my high school. If you were lucky enough to have a last name like Anderson or Charles, you probably made it through the gymnasium queue before 9 a.m., Your smile looks genuine. If you were a Daniels or an Elton, you probably picked up on the fact that something had happened. Gossip spreads like wildfire in any high school, but hadn't yet gone back to a classroom with a television. If you're a Gore or a Hein like me, you were screwed. You had to watch the whole terrible thing unfold before your eyes, and then you had to sit to have your picture taken for the yearbook. The command to smile sounded like the worst insult.
Age 17, 12th grade.
Joanne Fischetti, Staten Island. We were told we should leave school and go immediately home. I remember walking to the park with my best friend and talking about whether things will be the same again and whether we'd be able to have a prom, be able to go to